Hi, everyone. I'm Ashley McManus, Senior Director of Global Marketing at SmartEye. Welcome to the Human-Centric AI Podcast, where each episode we feature thought leaders doing cutting-edge work in the AI space. A little bit about us, SmartEye is the global leader in human insight AI, technology that understands, supports, and predicts human behavior in complex environments, bridging the gap between humans and machines for a safe and sustainable future. Today's episode features SmartEye Deputy CEO Dr. Rana El-Khalioubi, formerly co-founder and CEO of Affectiva, moderating a discussion with Pernilla Bulow, PhD, founder and CEO of the nonprofit Mind Blossom, and Lauren Larson of Videra Health. On Mental Health Awareness Day, these three came together to put a spotlight on this issue and delve into the role technologies like Emotion AI can play in mental health. The panelists also discussed the ethical concerns surrounding the use of technology in mental health and how they can be addressed. Additionally, they examine the potential impact of this tech on mental health research and how it can be used to identify new treatments and therapies. The discussion highlights the potential of recent technology advancements to revolutionize the way we approach mental health and underscores the importance of responsible and ethical use of this technology. Let's listen in to learn more.
All right. Hi, everybody. We are live. If we haven't met before, I'm Rana El-Khalioubi, Deputy CEO at SmartEye, by way of acquisition of my company that I co-founded, Affectiva, where I was CEO for a number of years. I'm very excited to do this live stream today. It's been a while, actually. Today is Mental Health Awareness Day. It's something that's very near and dear to my heart, and it is a very important subject that we all need to be talking about and prioritizing in our lives. So I'm very excited to be doing this today. Mental health is a significant and growing problem worldwide, especially coming out of COVID. Millions of people are struggling with a variety of mental health conditions, including depression, anxiety, PTSD. And the traditional approaches to mental health often involves very subjective self-reporting of symptoms, which can be imprecise and incomplete. And we have an opportunity to bring technology to bear, specifically artificial emotional intelligence or emotion AI, or the broader category of human sensing and human, you know, even wearable technologies. And so the example I'd like to give here is when you walk into a doctor's office, the doctor doesn't ask you what your blood pressure is. They just measure it. We have tools that can quantify your blood pressure. But with mental health disease, the gold standard is still on a scale from 1 to 10. How depressed are you? How suicidal are you? And the data is not that accurate. And again, we have an opportunity to bring objective measures to bear. And so I'm very, very excited about this conversation today. I have two wonderful guests. Lauren Larson is the founder and CEO of Videra Health, a remote patient behavioral health monitoring platform. Lauren and I go way back. We've been collaborating for a number of years now. While I was at, you know, at Affectiva, he spoke at our Emotion AI Summit. Lauren, you're featured in my book, Girl Decoded. And a disclaimer, I serve on the board of Videra Health. And I love the mission of this company. And as I tell you, Lauren, after each board meeting, I just feel very grateful that I get to be on this journey with you and your team.
You're on it with us.
Thank you for being here today. And then Pernilla Bulow is our rock star. She is founder and CEO of Mind Blossom. She received her PhD in neuroscience from Emory University and then did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Harvard Medical School and Mass General Hospital. Then left academia and decided to join industry where she at iMotions, the company we acquired last year. It's a multimodal platform for bringing a lot of behavioral signals together. Pernilla, you and I, we were having lunch one day in the office and we very quickly kind of figured out that we're both very passionate about mental health and we bring different perspectives to it. And I've really appreciated our conversations and I love what you're doing too and your mission to reduce and prevent mental illness, in particular focused on K-12 and college students. So I think it's a very important topic. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So I thought we would start with you, Lauren. Just tell us a little bit about your story and also the origin story of Videra.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here. So I'm a computer scientist by training. I've worked in a lot of different areas in technology, from building chips to hardware for computer networking, early internet television. And I found a way to a company called HireVue in around 2011. And HireVue was trying to figure out how to make hiring better and how to let more people be interviewed, be seen for more than just the resume, let companies go to more places to see more candidates than they could before. In hiring, the problem is you value somebody on a resume, then you try to set up a phone interview, which isn't scalable. You can only see 10 people per recruiter per day. And so a lot of people just don't get a shot at interviewing for a job that they would be great at. And so we applied video to that and let people sort of interview whenever they want, wherever they want. You'd set it, you know, create a set of questions that they could answer, and they could answer those questions, and then someone would watch them. And you could watch them faster than trying to do live interviews. But at some point, we had to figure out, like, could we really scale that and say, if you had 100,000 people interview for a job or a set of jobs, how could you evaluate them? And so that's where you and I started collaborating around, how do we use AI to measure what really matters in a job, what really predicts performance in a way that is fair? Hiring is not a fair process today in any way. And so it was a really fun journey to try to figure that out. And I think that company has been really successful. We've done over 30 million job interviews and applied AI to that and figured out what ethical AI means applied to hiring, which was great. And along the way, people kept saying, this is cool technology. You can get to know somebody on a video. You can predict something from it. Couldn't you apply this in healthcare? And so that's really where Videra came from, is how do we apply those learnings to healthcare? In healthcare, there's similar problems. We don't have enough people to see the people that need to be seen. Just like in recruiting, you just don't have a chance to be seen by a person. And so how do we apply AI to that? And that's what we've been working on at Videra. We're next year, it's predicted we'll be somewhere between 15,000 and 32,000 psychiatrists short in the United States. Like, we just don't have enough people. And 86% of psychologists have reported they have some sign of burnout. So how do we help scale the people we have? Because that's still the best way to get treated, make them more efficient by using technology. And that's what Videra is trying to solve for.
I will say my daughter is a sophomore in college, and it's a top university, and it's like a 3 months wait if you wanted to get mental health support, which is crazy. It's insane. Yeah. It might be too late.
It might be too late. And we just don't have a way to solve that today. And that's where technology can help.
Absolutely. Pranila, how about you? What got you a little bit about your story and how you got into mental health?
Yeah. So this was a great segue, actually. My background is very mixed between coming from an academic neuroscience psychology background, where we've been doing a lot of research, and then from the more practical perspective of working, both have, personal, life experiences, which I really think like most of us and everybody here can relate to, that it rings a bell and it makes this a very relevant conversation. But then I also work with clients specifically, mostly pro bono, where I see people that are struggling with mental health. I see people like, your daughter, Rana, who cannot get access to a therapist, even though they have insurance. And then I also work with people that do not have insurance, Those are the really terrible cases to see. They're homeless. They don't know where to go. I mean, it's just, it's very challenging. How do you help those people, right? So my background has been very rooted in psychology and neuroscience, understanding, why is it we become the way we are? I'm super enthusiastic about those big questions. I love talking to anybody out there. If you want to connect and have these conversations, I am happy to. So trying to figure out, how do we become the way we are? And I became super interested in understanding, why is it some people get a mental illness and some people don't? And so now we're in this question of resilience, vulnerability, and then we jump into nature versus nurture. So what is it that makes some people, more susceptible? Is it genetic factors? Is it socioeconomic factors, environmental factors? And I really, after having done many years of research, I really, really think the environment, and this encompasses everything, your family, the society you grow up in, what is your socioeconomic status, really, really influences our mental health. And so Mind Blossom comes out of that as an opportunity to try to bring resources, especially to students that are from more impoverished areas, and give them those resources that you would otherwise only get if you come from richer, wealthier neighborhoods. Everybody is susceptible to mental illness. This is not something that only targets one particular group of the society, but there are certain things we can do to help the people that are most at risk.
That's awesome. Great. So I want to kind of, and I want to actually first welcome everybody who is joining us live. I can already see that there are some comments. If you are tuning in live, please let us know where you're tuning in from, and keep your questions coming. I'm monitoring them, and at some point I'll bring them into the conversation. And thank you for joining us again. So I want to kind of dive in. All right. So how can we bring technology to bear to help with diagnosis, but also potentially treatment of mental health? And Lauren, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think, that's usually how I sort of bucket it, is like, how do we see what's happening and then how do we help with it? And I think, you know, we are seeing some digital therapeutics come out. Although there are real challenges with, I think we have to be careful. Does that technology work? Is it engaging? Even though something works and people won't continue to do it, it actually won't work. It might work in a trial, but it won't work in the real world. And we've seen, you know, companies like Pear Therapeutics that has, therapeutics for substance use disorder go bankrupt recently because there aren't ways to get paid for that in ways that really make it commercially viable. And so, you know, I think I'm a little bit concerned that treatment is still best done by people. I don't think we're quite to the point where AI is a replacement for a really good therapist. Mm-hmm. Might be better than your therapist, but it's not better than a really good therapist. And there's a difference in quality between therapists as well, right? And so you can't really say humans are better than machines. Right. But I think in general, the best way for someone to get treatment today is still with a really well-trained mm-hmm. person. That will change over the next few years. And then I think on the monitoring side of just knowing how someone is doing is a really important thing. And that's really where we're focused today. At Bidera, of just who out there in your population as a provider that you're taking care of needs help. And, people sign up for insurance plans and the insurance plan doesn't know that you need help until you show up in the ER with the mental health crisis. And that can be kids to elderly people. You're just invisible to the system until you show up for help to a system that's already incapable of handling all the people that need help. And so, I think if we can start to monitor people with technology and say, okay, who are the people out there that are most in need, most likely to experience a crisis? Let's put our people on those. And then I think, like Brunel, you're building some programs that maybe could help intervene early for people who are lower acuity, and let's keep them from getting to crisis. Mm-hmm. And start to apply technology and really helping our people have impact, so that their time is spent with data that's been collected by technology, that's been sort of analyzed by technology, but then, lets them get straight to treatment and intervention, which is what people are really good at.
Can you walk us through what the Bidera kind of app or platform looks like, both from a patient perspective, but also from a kind of a clinician perspective?
What Bidera looks like?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that we think about it, and we can be sort of before you've seen somebody, can we just screen somebody up front before they see a clinician? So when the clinician sees you, if you go to your primary care doc, they have 8 minutes. They're very likely statistically to miss what's going on with mental health because they're focused on other things, but you might have something they could address. We're sort of in between visits when you're in treatment, like what's going on when you're outside that office, because when you leave the office, your doctor doesn't have time to think about you again. They're just busy on the next patient. They're already overloaded. And then after treatment. So you leave, say, addiction recovery treatment, or you've been hospitalized for a mental health condition. What happens when you leave? Typically, your provider has no idea, but you might stop taking your medication and become suicidal. That's a real challenge. So the way that we usually do is we put you in some kind of a program which says, okay, after you leave, we're going to check in with you 24 hours after, 72 hours, a week after, a month, and ideally ongoing. You get a text saying, hey, your doctor would like to hear how you're doing. Just click this link. You don't need an app. You don't need a login. You just click a link, answer questions on video. sometimes there are multiple choice questions as well, but we really want it to be you expressing yourself in your own words.
You're literally recording a video. There's no human. There's no human on the other side, correct? Yeah,
you can do it at 11 p.m. when you finish your day. You can do it, you know, parked in your car outside of work when you just want to, you know, talk about what's happening. So it's really scalable. You can check in with thousands of patients in a single week from a provider. And so the provider is getting data back about all these people. And we look at what someone says, the verbal and then the nonverbal, how they say it, tone of voice, gaps in speech, rate of speech, and then video, movements, facial expressions, to sort of replicate, like, what would a clinician, if they had time to see you, what would they think is happening with you? And so it's a very simple patient experience. If you can kind of like click buttons, you can do it. My dad can do it and he can't send me a text because that's lots of buttons. And then from the clinician's perspective, we want to make this really easy. Say like, look, you had 1,000 people check in this week. Here are 10 that we saw something concerning. Mm-hmm. Double click on each person, see what was happening. The AI should sort of say, we thought this person was in emotional distress. Here's why. They said this, this, and this. So that the clinician can make a clinical judgment. We're not trying to do diagnostics. We're not trying to tell them how to treat the patient today. I mean, we will get there, but we're just saying you're the expert, but here's data you couldn't have had without technology.
And you have a really powerful example of where this worked.
Yeah. This is just an example of where someone gets lost in the system. We had a patient named Rico who was not his real name. Who went to
one of our,
that's not his real name. But went to one of our patients for treatment. Was severely depressed. They stabilized him, got him on medication. He was discharged, went home, went to his primary care doctor, who questioned why he was taking those medications, felt they were going to interfere with something else he was being treated for. So he stopped taking the medication. 3 days later, he's sitting at home on a Saturday night. He lives with his parents. They're on vacation. He's alone. He feels like he's severely depressed. He feels like he's failed therapy again. His parents are going to be disappointed in him. There's a lot of shame about reaching out for more help. Fortunately, he gets a text from his provider, which is from Vidara Health, saying, hey, we just want to hear how you're doing. He's got nothing else going on. He answers the questions really authentically. Our algorithms were able to identify what we call emotional distress, alerted the on-call nurse, who then reached out and persuaded him to come back. And it was a bit of a, he was kind of done. He was ready to go. But they persuaded him to come back and get more treatment. Typically, he would be completely lost to them. They had no idea what was happening with him. They did not know this was happening. But he told them the next morning, he said, look, if you hadn't reached out last night, I wouldn't be here anymore. I was going to take my life last night. And that was my only cry for help. He didn't have anyone to tell him. And that's where technology can really see people who are currently invisible to our system. And I think that's, you know, something we should be applying technology to, because people just get lost.
Yeah, I love the tagline, like, technology can help us see people who are like invisible to the system. And I do that at scale, right? I do that longitudinally, objectively. I think that's such a powerful story. Pernilla, you spend a lot of time doing multimodal research, and you know, a big part of, for example, what Vidara is doing is bringing these disparate signals, like what you say and how you say it, and your facial expressions when you say it. What's your experience kind of researching multimodal signals and how it relates to mental health?
Yeah. So I agree completely with what Lauren mentioned in terms of the technology is not really there yet. Where we see from like the academic standpoint, the most validity in wearables, for example, and other types of biosensors is as a supplement to assessment or monitoring. There are various diagnostic tools out there. Neuropsychology is full of them, but they're usually always survey questions. And maybe we can try to gamify or in other ways make those more technologically specific. But where I see from the academic standpoint, that wearables can really step in and different biosensors is an assessment. Now, I, as you mentioned, I spend a lot of my time reviewing papers and actually doing a lot of testing in-house of various different types of devices that exist. it's unfortunate to say it, but a lot of them are just not on par with what we need. So there are technologies out there that they just, they say they can do something and they can't. And so the moment that they're being tested rigorously by academic standards, they don't fulfill the potential. So there's a lot of really, really cool stuff out there. And that's not to discredit all of the different wearables that exist, but just to have a more realistic attitude as to what can a heart rate sensor really tell you. Cool, you're a little bit stressed right now, but what does that mean, right? And how do you contextualize that? And that's where we really want to have the more multimodal aspect of understanding, you know, multiple data streams. AI is going to be so powerful, machine learning that can find patterns in different types of technology data that's coming in. So as Lauren was mentioned, your voice, your language, your face, like when we start finding patterns in all those three streams and more, that's when we start really having something solid that we can utilize. But I agree. And obviously, like from a Mind Blossom perspective, we're all humans. It's kind of funny. I spend so much of my time in technology. But this company that I founded, this nonprofit that I founded, is really focused on utilizing humans, right? But utilizing strategies that are evidence-based, implementing technology when we know it's helpful, but taking the human perspective when we know that's the best.
So give us an example of how your nonprofit is going about this.
Yeah. So psychoeducation is really the principle driving everything that we do. So psychoeducation is exactly what it sounds like. Okay. It's teaching and learning about what happens in your mind and in your body, why you behave the way you do. Super simple. We have so much research, literal research from back in the 70s, where we can show that this method works to alleviate symptoms and distress in not just patient populations, but also caregivers. And these are people that have schizophrenia. These are caregivers of people with schizophrenia. These are teachers that are teaching special ed kids. These are people with severe depression, postpartum depression, suicidal ideation. Like there are so many ways in which this has been demonstrated. And for some reason that I cannot comprehend, it has not been implemented in settings where we can actually take advantage of it. And so if you go into a hospital or a psychiatric unit, or you go to a really good clinical psychologist, you'll probably receive psychoeducation. Mm-hmm. But who goes there? Those right. are the people that are in intense distress and have already reached the threshold of being in a very, very bad state of mind, or the people with a lot of money, right? And so that's where we're totally losing out on utilizing evidence-based methods to actually help people, not just prevent, but also reduce existing mental illness. And then what I think it's nice to drop a note here for all the really cool apps that exist, all the like meditation apps and things like that. Now, I spend a lot of time trying to actually find really good evidence for them working. And there isn't much. I'll be honest about that. But anecdotally, and like what you're seeing people say, is that it works. And if this can give you a placebo effect that's actually makes you feel better, I'm cool right. with that. And I think those types of, you know, self-help guided apps, meditation, mindfulness, whatever you like to practice, I think we should absolutely support trying to get that out to all populations while also recognizing the limitations of it. This is not a stand-in for a therapist. It's not a stand-in for medications. It's not a stand-in for anything, but it's a really nice supplement to our lives to increase our life quality, which really all of this is about.
I remember in one of our conversations, we talked about the importance of community, being part of mm-hmm. a community, but also the importance of meaning and purpose in one's life. Yeah. Separately, I'm very interested in longevity, and I've been reading, you know, the Blue Zones and a lot of longevity research. I do find it really curious that the more people feel connected
yeah.
versus lonely, right?
Yeah.
How that contributes to positive mental health. So I don't know, what is the evidence behind that? What's the
There's
research?
So much. Yeah. I've actually written several articles on that as a part of my newsletter. And you're right, like people that are married tend to live longer. Is it because they're married or is it because they have a healthy partnership? Probably the latter, right? Because when we look, yeah. That's what we know from the science. I can go into the details. Happy to have a discussion on this. People that are widows, for example, that have strong friend groups tend to live longer. People that have a strong peer community, healthy family environments. And it's just research is showing again and again, not only does it change your mindset that you're happier, but your blood pressure is healthier. Your any type of number that you would normally go into the doctor and say, you know, what does it look like, is positively influenced by you having community and exercise and eating healthy and all of these things, right? But community is something that I think we have overlooked a lot, and it's something I spent a lot of time talking about. And finally, it seems to get some traction now that the general surgeon has come out and said that loneliness is the next big epidemic. especially social media playing a big role in people's lives. And there are just so many ways in which we can, you know, really discuss this topic. But community is a vitamin pill that we should all have.
I love that. Community is a vitamin pill. I loved Ashley's question here. Okay, so in, you know, in my daughter's example, do you both, I'm going to ask you both this question. Do you think an AI-powered therapist now is better than a three-month slash maybe too late wait? And how do we get there? What are some of the challenges? And I guess that's kind of somewhat related to all the craziness around ChatGPT. Could we, you know, could we use ChatGPT as a proxy to a mental health coach or therapist? Lauren?
Yeah, I think we've got sort of, there's not one answer to that question, because we've got people who are very high acuity who really need to see somebody. And then you've got people who are taking up space on a waiting list, by the way, and they might be gotten there a few weeks before somebody who really needs to be seen sooner. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is really intriguing to say, can we offload some of those people, put them in a program like you're building, Pranilla, or an AI developed one that would be helpful. Give them some skills, give them some breathing exercise, give them some workbooks, some, you know, lightweight cognitive behavioral therapy. I think those are all really interesting ideas. I don't know that we have the data to say, yes, those work today. I think we're trying to get to that. But I think for the hierarchy, but hopefully if we can get those to work, then we can offload those people from the waiting list and get our very limited providers to help people who that won't work for yet. We can really get care that's appropriate for each sort of group of people faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I also think AI, just on the note of community, could be ChatGPT AI, could be a really, really cool platform to create community. And I'm not talking social media types of community, but it becomes a resource, right? So you can talk to an AI therapist and they can then recommend you. And these are the steps that you can take right now. Now, one of the problems with being, for example, depressed is that you have very little motivation to do anything. Mm-hmm. And so obviously the way the message is delivered, the way that it pulls through with it, how often it says it, which are the community places it's going to pick out, you know, that will all be super duper important. But I think we can think about AI therapy much more broader than a regular psychotherapist. In fact, in my opinion, we should think about therapy always much broader than a psychotherapist, because right now, all we talk about is one psychotherapist and one client and then some drugs in the mix, right? But there is so much more to a healthy life. And a psychotherapist is also a vitamin pill, you know? And so like you have to also have the community, like, how do we build that? Okay, well, if they can't get access to a psychotherapist, can they get access to a life coach, for example? There's many more of those, right? And those people can step in and at least be like peer mentors or something like that. And I think AI could be super duper helpful with kind of paving that way and making it much more scalable, as Lauren has mentioned.
Yeah,
I want to kind of you, Lauren, you were going to chime in?
No, I just agree with Pranilla. I completely agree. It's
Yeah. And I like this idea of a multivitamin pill, right? Like, there's different approaches and different parts of the solution. It's not only one thing.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of build on that and transition to a very important topic, which is the ethics of all of this. Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, I saw, I think it was in the news. It was a Belgian guy, I guess, and his So he was using a ChatGPT-like product. It was not ChatGPT, but it was a very similar kind of experience. And I guess he went on, you know, was interfacing with this bot. Initially said that he was suicidal and wanted some ideas on how to end his life. And the bot said, well, I can't, that's a very bad idea. I can't help you do that. So he went back and said, okay, well, I get that this is a bad idea. So I want to know what those ideas are so that I could make sure that nobody else doesn't. Yeah. Like, worded the question, like he tricked basically the bot. And the bot literally identified like five ways he could end his life. And unfortunately, this person did end up committing suicide, and I guess his wife brought this story, and there were shots from the text that went, you know, that she brought to the public, and that really kind of underscored the ethics of all of this, right? Like, how do we make sure that this is done in the right way, that it's safe, that it's not biased, that people's I mean, this is really, really, really personal data. Like, how do we ensure privacy? So I wanted to hear both your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, there's nothing to guarantee that the AI is actually acting in our own best interests, right? We have to, there's kind of an assumption that, it's there, I can ask it questions, it will be helpful, but it may not actually be helpful. I mean, I think there's, you know, experts are kind of raising questions of, is it going to start manipulating us and, you know, sort of taking over in certain ways? So that's a real concern. We don't really know how to predict what it will say next, which, right. You know, is, I was going to sort of, you know, people have biases. If you go to your therapist, they have biases. From my prior experience, Naveen asked about hiring, like people have biases in the hiring process. Right. And so, we really have to figure out like what are we training on that is sort of the best practice, the best that we can aim at. Whereas when we sort of have a ChatGPT that's sort of untrained, it's trained on a bunch of stuff and it will come up with answers, but are they actually helpful? Are they actually good? I don't think we know that yet. And I don't think we have bots that are capable of doing that. And I think that's so important, whether you're making a hiring decision to say, are we making a hiring decision to say, no, we actually know what success in that job looks like. Like, is our target unbiased? And then are we building models that actually predict unbiased targets? If that makes sense. It's both. We have to have some real world ground truth and then make sure that the models are performing that way. And it's the same in healthcare. We have a lot of customers who will come to us and say, like, I want AI to help make my therapist better because I have no idea what they say when they're with the patient.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really know what our human therapists are doing or if it's working. There's a big deviation between great and severely mediocre with humans. Right. I think the promise of AI is we can start to say, this is good, let's do more of that. And it's very hard for humans to change, and it's very hard for humans to really get enough examples to really calibrate what's right, because we can only see 8 patients a day, 5 days a week. But an AI, in theory, should be able to see millions of examples and in theory be better. We're not there yet. But I think that's sort of the promise, is that we can make it truly world-class over time.
Do you think patients ought to know if they're talking to human or machine?
I think that they should know that. But I don't know how that affects the outcome, right?
Right. Exactly. You know,
maybe I know, different things to a bot than I would to a person. And I think that, that there's data that says that, right? And I think that's compelling.
Pernilla, you have a lot of thoughts on that, right?
Yeah, so there's different research, but it's just such a nascent topic. But on the topic of, you know, the AI, it's really only as good as the people that developed it, right? I know, and now we're getting to a breaking point where it's becoming better than the people that developed it. And hopefully that means that we can somehow also overcome the biases of the people that developed it. Mm-hmm. And biases are oftentimes unconscious. We don't know we have them, and we keep doing them. Even when we think that we are very intentional about not having them, we still have them. It's terrible. Human nature, it's okay. Like, there's nobody is at fault for this, other than we can try to educate ourselves. All of those DEI trainings that you guys have probably gone through out there in the audience, there is no research to showcase that they work. You know, do your best, but also don't hate yourself. I think one of the big layers of this conversation is, where is the line between privacy and access to something that really, really works.
Mm-hmm.
And then restriction for everybody to get access to those things that work. Because basically what we're talking about now is, should that person who ended up committing suicide have been able to communicate with the chat box about this topic, right?
Right.
And so one answer could be, whenever those types of words come up, the chat box just has to say, no, I can't talk about it. But I know there'll be a lot of people out there that will say, that's not good. We should all have the right to go and talk about suicide with the chat box. And, you know, I can sympathize with both perspectives, but are we ethically obligated to say, listen, we have this technology and it's really cool, but we also need to limit how much we can get access to it because the consequences can be very severe. Now, the other question is, would this person just have gone to YouTube and just found another way to commit suicide, right? Like, yes, he used the chat box in this case, but if you're very determined, you'll probably find a way anyways. So there are just so many layers to the conversation where, yeah, I think it really influences, you know, the ethics of it too.
I think this also, one of my favorite studies that's now a number of years old, was conducted at the University of Southern California. They had an avatar, like an emotion AI enabled avatar, see a group of PTSD patients. And then they had human clinicians see, you know, another group of PTSD patients. And what they found was really, really interesting. The patients were more forthcoming with the avatar because they perceived the avatar to be non-judgmental. Like, here's the thing, they're interacting with it. It's very patient. It has all the time in the world. It's not going to make judgments about who they are. In this particular case, they were vets. And I think there's a broader question here, which is, what does that say about us as humans, right?
Yeah. I think it underscores the stigma against therapy, that we see therapy as, and with me, I mean, the broader we, especially subgroups, so veterans, they see therapy as something that is weak. It's weak to get therapy, you know, whereas an AI chat box is a resource. You can use it. You can get, you know, the non-judgmental resources that you'll get from it. That would be my take on it. But obviously, there are many more layers.
All right. So I'll start wrapping us up here. I guess a question to both of you. What are some of the things, one thing that you're most excited about for this coming year?
That's a great question. I'm excited to see technology starting to touch patients. I think we're just starting. A lot of things have been built. I think we're early at Vidara Health. Obviously, people in the chat are building some really cool things. I'm excited to see these things really start to impact patients, which I think we've been more in the building phase. And I think we're starting to see healthcare providers embrace AI. I mean, healthcare never changes quickly, but with ChatGPT coming out, we're seeing more and more people just approaching us saying, okay, we want to do AI now. Whereas before, I think people were very skeptical. And I think we have to be careful that we don't misstep and overstate the claims and have people lose trust with AI. I think we're pretty willing to overlook it when our doctor makes a mistake, but gosh, if a Tesla makes a mistake on a highway, AI is bad, even though, you know, 90 people passed the accident texting on their phone. So we have to be careful as we roll this out, but I think we're now entering a phase where we're really going to start to see impact over the next few years.
Awesome. Pranilla?
I'd say the same thing, but I can add another thing. I'd say the same thing. And the main reason I want to emphasize that is because we need to have things that actually work. And right now we have a lot of different options out there that are not necessarily proven to work. And so coming from the research perspective and being a little bit of a stickler, I'd love to see that the companies themselves, even if that's how it goes, like that you can do some white papers or anything like that that can document more extensively how well it works, instead of just saying that after 8 weeks, 40% were more happy. You know, like stats are nice, but many of us want to see the data. And then just to add on to that, I think something I'm excited about is having people realize what we have already been talking about a lot, which is that AI cannot substitute humans entirely. AI is really good for some things and humans are really good for another. So kind of recognizing that and finding the balance between them. And figuring out when do we need one thing and when do we need the other and when do we need both. I'm excited to see more companies paying more attention to humans again. and bringing that back into the picture instead of making it, you know, that now you just have a chatbot that's your therapist. I personally don't think we are there yet, and I'm not sure we should be there.
Right.
I don't really want to get there. I want to talk to a real person sometimes, right? So that's what I'm excited about.
You know, this is a topic for another live stream, but I've been really thinking about, I put it under this umbrella of rehuman. Like, what does it mean to be human in the age of AI, right? And what does this partnership between, you know, humans and AI really look like? So I've been really pondering about that. But that is a conversation for a different live stream. All right, so last question. I'll give you both an opportunity to tell everybody an ask. Like, what's your ask? What would be most helpful to each of you? And then how can people reach you?
Great. I think, you know, we're excited about, you know, helping people measure mental health better and help guide care so people get to the right place at the right time. If you're interested in that, if we can help collaborate, we'd love you to reach out. We're at www.viderahealth.com.
And Lauren, you partner with a lot of behavioral health clinics and hospitals, right? Like, say a little bit more about your ideal customer or partner.
Yeah, our customers are both people who are on the payer side of, I'm responsible for paying for people's mental health, and we want to do that more effectively, to people who are directly providing care. So addiction recovery systems, mental health systems, hospitals with mental health, helping with mental health in emergency rooms. Those are all customers for us, as well as schools, military groups as well that we're serving.
Great. So if you are in any of these areas, please reach out. We'd love to work with you. Pranila, how about you?
Yeah. So you can read more about MindBlossom on mindblossom.org. We have kind of three groups of people that we work with. Schools and colleges, and then we have companies, and then we have organizations in general. That could be maybe a 12-step program or, you know, some kind of recovery, residential treatment house. The way that we work, because we're a nonprofit, is that we try to have clients that can pay, and any of those profits will then go into developing programs for schools and colleges that serve impoverished students. So by being a client, you're also helping many other people. And we have various ways in which you can have local impact. And you can, of course, also sponsor or donate directly. And you can literally tell us which school to go to. We don't care where we're going. We just want to do the work. And then, of course, we do partner with different companies. So if you have any type of tool or approach where you know that this really helps in breaking down stigma and biases, it helps in improving mental health, particularly in school children and college students, then we are super open to hearing that and working on collaborating together.
Amazing. And what's the best way to reach you?
So you can go to mindblossom.org and literally just send an email there. Or you can go to my website, which is my name, which is spelled weirdly, Pernille and then Buelow.com. And there you can read about everything that I do, because I have only talked about a fraction here.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you both. And for anybody who's joining, I'm very easy to find online to see me if you have any further thoughts or feedback or suggestions. Tune into our podcast. We often talk about a lot of these subjects as well. And thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you both for joining. This was great. And I'm glad we were able to have this conversation.
You too. Thanks, Rana.
I thought this was a fascinating discussion, especially as mental health is a significant and growing problem worldwide, with millions of people struggling with various mental health conditions such as depression, anxiety, and PTSD. The traditional approach to mental health treatment involves subjective self-reporting of symptoms, which can be imprecise and incomplete. Additionally, many individuals with mental health conditions may feel stigmatized or hesitant to seek help. These challenges highlight the need for more accurate, objective, and personalized approaches to mental health treatment. listening to how technologies like Videra Health and Emotion AI could step in here to provide insights into an individual's emotional state, enabling that more accurate diagnosis and personalized treatment of mental health conditions, really emphasize the potential of technology to revolutionize the way we approach mental health treatment and ultimately improve outcomes for millions of people worldwide. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Human-Centric AI podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts for new episodes. We are also on social media, so please reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram to share any feedback you have on the show and weigh in on the discussion using hashtag #ahumancentricaipodcast. Don't forget to rate us and comment with your feedback to help make the podcast more discoverable for others. Until next time, thanks for listening.